Happy Monday, everybody. Welcome to Drive Through HR. Your host, Brian Wimpen, William Tinkup, and Nisha coming to you live every day talking about human resources. So, William, how are you doing today with all this March madness going on?
You know, I made my bracket out this morning, and just like everybody else, you try to, like, think that you'll, you know, pick all the winners and all that stuff. The truth is there's so many upsets, and you can never pick all the winners. But I have Louisville winning it all. I have Rick Pitino cutting down the nets, which is probably not a popular choice, considering that there's a lot of good teams. But you know what? I'm in. I mean, March Madness comes around. I haven't watched a college basketball game all year long. Haven't followed it really at all, other than to know what the bracket, when the bracket comes out. I filled it out, and, of course, will not win anything. But you know what? It's just kind of something you do in March. But I'm doing great. I've got a little bit of a sore throat, but I'm doing great. Thanks for asking.
Take care. Well, wonderful. Let's get to our guest. I'm pretty excited to talk to her about this. Susan Traer, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Well, welcome to the show. Well, do us a favor, introduce yourself to the audience, and we'll talk about what's kind of going on in your world.
Sure. So I'm Susan Strayer Lamott. I'm trying to transition to my new name, both through SEO and personally, which is a hard thing to do. And I am the founder of Exaquio. We are a workforce consultancy. I've spent about the past 15 years both in-house in a number of HR functions for big brands and also as an HR consultant. And I really spend my time at the intersection of where business meets behavior. So what is the impact that talent and psychology and our organizations have on business performance? Lately, I've been really focused on culture, on brand development, and on talent strategies, especially in the digital space, which, of course, is a big part of what we do. I also am a board member for Recruit DC here in Washington, D.C., where I'm based, and I'm an advisor to a new startup called Remarkable Hire.
Nice. Oh, I'm sorry, Nisha.
Okay. Go ahead. Oh, yeah, I was saying that's wonderful. So I'd like to hear, you know, all this, with all this March Madness, what's on top of your mind these days?
Well, as it goes with March Madness, we have a rivalry in our house. My husband is a huge Duke fan, and I'm a Virginia Tech Hokie, and unfortunately our basketball season was terrible this year. In fact, none of my university allegiances, I'm an alum of Virginia Tech, of GW, George Washington University, and of Vanderbilt. None of them made the tournament, so I don't have anyone personally to root for. But I'm really hoping for some big upsets in this year's tournament. While all the number one seeds, I think, are really strong, I'm looking for some really interesting teams to make it pretty far. I'm originally from Philadelphia, so I'd like to see Temple get somewhat through. I think they have a better team than they've had in a number of years.
Nice. Well, let's continue the March Madness stuff. And, you know, this always, every year we talk about, it's the same thing after a lot of the major holidays, but we talk about March Madness and the positives that you have in that, and the bonding and, the, you know, parts of office culture that can be fun. But also let's talk a little bit about how it can be detrimental to worker productivity. What's your take on the whole thing?
Well, you know, I read an article that came out in Forbes yesterday by a guy named Darren Heitner, and he talks about how the sort of productivity problem with March Madness is overstated, and I couldn't agree more. I think every year we look for, I should say really every day, we look for numbers to help propel clicks, right? We want to be able to say you're going to lose X amount of dollars or you're going to create a huge problem if you do Y. And I think there, he talks about in his article how every year Challenger Grain Christmas comes out with a report about how much money is lost due to worker productivity during March Madness. And I think from a cultural perspective, we would really behoove ourselves to look at it in a much different way and really have fun with it. I know a number of organizations shut down live video access on their systems during March Madness, and it's a really detrimental thing to do because, quite frankly, all of that is available on our personal devices, so you can shut it down on my computer. I'm still going to watch a game if I want to watch a game. I'm still going to take a long lunch or maybe work from home or college sick. So I think we need to wrap ourselves around it and have fun with it. Make it part of the culture. Give your employees an opportunity to show their university allegiance, you know, wearing sweatshirts to work. Now, whatever it is that you do, you've got to tie it into your strategy and your own, you know, the culture in your own organization. But I still think we should look at it in a very different way than we usually do.
Yeah, it's funny. On one hand, we're all talking about how do we retain top talent and how do we engagement. I'm going to say engagement at least five times. Engagement. How do we create engagement? Yet, you know, something like this comes around. It's like, all right, how can we really just make it harder for the employees?
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny, that word engagement. We always talk about employee engagement as a way, how can we engage our employees in our business, in what we're doing? And I feel like that's a really selfish way to look at engagement. What we try to tell our clients is look at engagement from your employee's perspective. Find out, go to the source, what are they engaged in? And then find a way to insert yourself, your business, what you're working on into that engagement. So it's really that reverse way of looking at it rather than force-fitting or force-feeding engagement with your employees.
Nice. You know, let's stick there for a second. I call that mainlining feedback, which some people like that and some people don't, obviously. But what's the advice that you give people in terms of how often do you get feedback from your employees, and what are some of the means in which you do that? What are some of the tools in which you use to gather up feedback from employees?
Well, I know that a lot of you know, listeners and folks in HR are big fans of Gallup and doing engagement surveys on a regular basis, but I think engagement and feedback are two different things. When it comes to engagement, I recommend, and we recommend to our clients, whatever tool you use, make sure engagement data that's collected is very individualized. So rather than asking, do you have a best friend at work, ask, what do you talk about with your best friend at work? Find out the nitty-gritty, the depth of why your employees are engaged or why not. When it comes to feedback, I look at that as a different perspective. That's not about the individual employee, but it's about the contribution they can make to the workplace. What do they think about what's happening, what's going on, what makes sense to them, what doesn't? Lars Schmidt of NPR, he also writes that Amplify Talent blog. He and I co-authored a blog a couple of weeks ago. It's on both the execweo.com blog as well as the Amplify Talent blog. And he and I looked at a tool called Tiny Pulse. There's a new organization called Tiny HR. And essentially what Tiny Pulse is, it's the first basically tool out of this Tiny HR organization. And the guy who started Tiny HR decided that he wanted a way to get feedback on a regular basis. So Tiny Pulse are these sort of one-question surveys. And you can't customize the questions right now, but essentially it gets the pulse of your organization at any given moment. And, you know, what Lars and I talked a lot about is the importance of getting more regular feedback as opposed to getting feedback once or twice a year. You know, if you ask one or two questions every 2 weeks and you chart that data and you look at it in depth and you break it down, you'll get a real sense of how that correlates with exactly what's happening in your organization. And that can drive more meaningful change because you'll see those patterns as opposed to just looking for kind of a general malaise or a general happiness once or twice a year.
Nice. Let's talk about how do you know when you've reached the apex of engagement? Like when do you know you've kind of nailed it?
Two things. One is you see fit in your organization. So you see individuals that can really work well with each other, and when they argue, when they debate, they do it in a really constructive way. That, to me, is demonstrative of an engaged employee. And part of the way that you see that is in the kind of feedback that you get and from, you know, from your employee set. So when you're looking at the feedback they're sharing, when you're looking at the qualitative content, does it come across as really antagonistic and frustrated, or does it come across as hopeful, you know, when they make their recommendations? Because employees that aren't engaged, their feedback has a real antagonistic undertone to it. employees who are, their feedback comes across as hopeful because they feel like the feedback that they're giving could actually be taken into account or could actually be implemented. So when we work with organizations, we want to get them to that hopeful tone, that partnership tone, so that you know people are willing to face adversity together. They're willing to endure being adversarial because they know that that sometimes helps to solve problems. But at the end of the day, they do it in a way that's much more indicative of a partnership rather than of, you know, rather than of frustration and anger and hopelessness, if you will.
What's the end game of engagement for you?
I don't know that there is an end game because engagement is going to be dictated by what's going on in the business. So at any organization at any time, no one reaches the apex of engagement. You don't get to the best engagement possible and stop because then something can happen in your business that could change engagement. Something could happen in your industry or your field. You know, with all of the sequestration stuff that's happening here in D.C., even for organizations that are highly engaged, you know, when a quarter of your coworkers are furloughed, that's going to have an effect on engagement no matter how good you are. So for me, I think there is no end game. It's really about a maintenance game. It's really about keeping on top of it constantly. And it's really about making sure that that is outside of HR. Yes, this can be a process and a culture shift that HR helps drive, but it's really got to be embraced by leadership in general.
Let's pivot over to culture. Where does culture come from? Like, how do you know what it is and what it looks like and what it feels like when you have or do not have culture?
Culture has to come from the top, for sure. One of the things that we do is we work with startups to help them define their culture. Part of it is organic. You can't just sit down in a room and say, this is our culture, because the individuals that are part of your startup team, for example, have to all embrace that and be a part of it. So part of it is organic. It's inbred and born in who starts an organization and who's leading the organization. And then the other part of culture is defined. It has to serve as a bit of a litmus test. It has to be written down so that it can be followed. It can be something that you're held accountable for. I don't know if any of you all have been in the Container Store lately. I am a super organizing freak. My husband once said to me, "You've contained everything in our house you can possibly contain." So I'm in the Container Store a lot. And one of the things that they have at every register is a card that says what we stand for. And they're really clear and vocal about saying, this is our culture, this is what you'll experience, not only as a customer, but as an employee. And it's their way of holding themselves accountable. And I think that's a really beautiful mix between organic and defined, because it does come from the employees. They played a large role in helping to define it. But now it's defined, and it'll, you know, it helps the organization from a hiring perspective self-select, but it also helps them hold themselves accountable to be able to say, hey, this is what we said we were going to stand for, and an employee or a leader can come up and say, you know, we're acting in a way that doesn't match this. Ritz Carlton does the exact same thing with their credo card, and I can say from having worked there for a long time that they absolutely live that, and that credo card helps them to hold themselves accountable as well.
Nice. The relationship between culture and values, what is that for you?
Values are really the essence or the foundation of the culture. So I always think about it personally, right? If you have a partner or a spouse, you have a set of shared values. That's the foundation for your relationship. And you make decisions and you live and breathe by those values. And when you don't, when you make a decision that's not in alignment with those values, it feels uncomfortable, sort of like if you're right-handed and I make you sign your name with your left hand. That's essentially what it is. And the culture is what comes out of living those values. What does it look like when you live those values every day? What does it look like when you don't live those values and you're held accountable for it? It's simple, really, when you think about it. It's just much harder to put into practice.
Well, wonderful. I'm going to do a quick quiz with everybody. This is Misha and William talking to our wonderful guest all about employee engagement, building your employer brand and culture. Well, when employers define their, you know, master brand culture for successful engagement and employee retention. What could be the missing factors that you have seen, and just because of that, they're not able to nail it?
I think the biggest one is driving to execution. Every article that I see on brands and culture, especially on employer brand these days, and seems to be really focused on how do we brand ourselves, not the why and the what. One of the things most organizations fail to do is the research into what their brand should be. And by research, I don't mean looking at competitors and looking at the market. Of course, that stuff's important. I mean looking deeply at the workforce to see who is your workforce, what are they like. You wouldn't marry someone after knowing them for just a day or knowing just the very basics about them. You know, in order to marry someone or to have a relationship with a business partner, for example, you really want to get to who they are and what they believe in and what matters to them. And we don't do that with our employees. When we go out, when Exaplio, our company, goes out and does an employer brand engagement, we start with research, but one of the things we do in particular is start with what I call emotional research. We want to get a sense of not just how employees feel in the workplace, but how do they feel in their general lives? What do they think and feel in the morning when they're getting ready for work? What are they thinking about on their commute, both into work and on the way home? What is that emotion? What does that feel like? And that helps give us an essence of who they are and helps us look for the broader trends across the workforce that really drive what the brand is. And if you look at marketers on the consumer side, they do the exact same thing. They look at the emotions of their customers. And I don't know why it's taking HR so long to really understand that and to learn that. I've got a couple of hunches as to why, but, you know, it is frustrating to see us talk about employer brand as execution, as, you know, tweeting our jobs or we've got to have a great career site. Stuff is all important, but it can't come until you define the brand like a real marketer does.
Nice. Let me ask about your personal brand. I had a guy at a bar tell me one time that women that use their maiden name as hyphenated to their newly married name are more prone to get divorced. And I am not. And, you know, it was very logical after about, you know, 18 beers. It was, you know, I believe the guy. It seemed like he did a lot of scientific study, of course. But, you know, the thing is, his whole bit was, and I think it was all mostly a joke, or he was just recently divorced himself, not really sure. But I think his whole bit was it's all about giving up that brand. If you've built a brand, you know, as a woman, and all of a sudden now you're married, now you have a new brand. And I, you know, no one's got the answer to any of this stuff, but you are going from someone unknown, Susan Strayer, a fantastically known person, to Susan Lamont. Or Strayer Lamont, I should say. And so you're going through all that. What, first of all, in all of that process, what have you learned?
Well, I've learned that it's, you know, it's important to have those conversations with your spouse. And my husband and I did, and he has been fantastically supportive. You know, he said, "Yeah, I'd love for you to take my last name, but you've got to do what works for you." I'm a really practical person. I'm a realist, so. And I read this article the other day about this couple who decided to create a new last name for themselves. And part of the problem was they had each been born with hyphenated last names. So they'd each been born into families where the parents had different last names, and they thought, if we then hyphenate our names, our kids are going to have like 10 last names. So the hyphenation doesn't work really for more than one generation. And I laughed because I thought, gosh, that is so impractical. So I plan on personally moving to Lamont shortly. And the strategy that I took is really one of a business strategy. I thought to myself, how do businesses who rebrand or change their name, how do they do it? So, for example, if you look at Kinko's that was purchased by FedEx, for a while they went by FedEx Kinko's. And yesterday I was at a FedEx office, which is now the new name for FedEx Kinko's, and there's a sign in the window that says Kinko's copying inside. And that's exactly the strategy I'm taking. So because all of my SEO and brand was Susan Strayer, and that's how people knew me, I've written two books, and so those were both under the name Susan Strayer. I do want to take my husband's last name solely, and that's the plan. And so I'm transitioning. I'm FedEx Kinko's right now. I'm using Strayer Lamont to help transition the SEO, where possible, I'm going back and changing my name on posts and places where I write. And then moving forward, I'll be known as Susan Lamott. I mean, for me, at the end of the day, as much as I love to work, I'm one of the most ambitious people I know. My family and my personal life is always going to be the most important. So that was the first thing I thought about when making the decision. And if I lose some SEO, you know, then well be it. It's much more important to me to have my husband than to have a great, you know, Google page ranking.
Nice. I want to ask you about your husband in a second because I think you all are going to be doing some stuff together. But let's talk about women for right now. Lean In, it's all the topic du jour. I want to get your take on kind of what you think, you know, the women's issues 2013 are.
So for me, I think the biggest issue is what women really want. I've got a post coming out tomorrow, unless they run it early today, but it should come out tomorrow in Forbes. And I've got a lot of opinions on the topic, but what I really think the problem is that women don't want what companies are offering. And I think part of the challenge with whether Sheryl Sandberg's initiative will succeed or not is whether organizations are willing to change. And what I mean by that is, you know, in the 1950s, there were only 30-some-odd percent of women in the workplace. By 1990, that number jumped to 50%. In 2010, you would think that number would have continued to rise, but it didn't. And this is all census data, U.S. census data. It stayed static. And I think there's still that 50-50 choice in the workplace. And what I realized, what changed for me from my 20s to my 30s is I realized it's just not possible. Women still carry a different set of burdens than men do, and with having to bear children, and that, you know, obviously scientifically and physiologically can't change, women are always going to have a different set of burdens. And almost all of the women that I talked to in preparation for this Forbes post, they all said to me, we don't want it anymore. We look at what it takes to get to the top, and we're just not interested. I think in my 20s, I thought I would be head of HR. You know, I thought my ambition would be to be head of HR for a big brand. And then I got to my 30s and had my own set of experiences and realized, I don't want that. I don't want what these companies are offering. And I think that's why there's not a lot of women in these positions. So promote all the women you want and make more opportunities for women. I don't think until the work changes that that's going to have any effect on women in higher positions or in more executive roles in the workplace.
Well, I've got to ask you about Marissa Myers, her decision, her most recent decision at Yahoo then. What's your take on that?
My initial reaction was, you know, great, layoffs in disguise. My take is the same that I would tell any organization. Unless you know the strategy, you know, you can't comment. Yeah, it sounds terrible to say don't work at home. And it's funny, I mean, Exactly, it was a virtual company, and so our team members are working all over the place. And so that strategy wouldn't work for us. But for Yahoo, I think that strategy works. I get it. They are trying to rebrand a company and remake a company. And in doing so, they need people that are unequivocally passionate about Yahoo, are on board with Marissa Myers' direction and where she's headed. And so it makes perfect sense to me. Do I think it's the right decision? I'd really have to better understand their strategy and what they're trying to achieve. But it seems to me like it's a strategic decision and not a take or a statement on, you know, work-life balance or working at home. That's precisely why I'm personally not working at an organization like that. And, you know, hopefully they have those conversations in Yahoo to be able to say what effect is this decision going to have on working mothers, for example. She's got a nursery in her office, so it can't be that hard for her.
Truth. Do you think the outrage is different because she's, like if that was a male CEO, the previous dude that was interim, had he made the exact same decision, the exact same communication, would we be more upset or less upset or the same?
I think we'd be the same amount of upset, but in a different way. It would be less of how can you do this to us and more that's so sexist. We'd still find a way to hold that person accountable and say, you know, John CEO shouldn't have done this and he's not thinking about women. The other thing is the personal situation of those individuals. You know, part of the reason I think Sheryl Sandberg is having trouble getting traction in some cases and getting a lot of flack is her personal situation. She lives in a 9,000-square-foot house. She has a team of people helping her. And so while I, you know, laud her and I laud Marissa Meyer for making those tough decisions and standing tall on behalf of women, at the same time, you know, makes it hard to relate to them and hard to say, gosh, you know, when I have kids, you know, I don't know that I'm going to be able to hire a ton of hired help to help me. I'm going to have to figure this out on my own. And that's who I want to hear from, are the role models that that figured it out on their own. And there aren't too many of them, quite frankly. That's what I heard from a lot of women. Those role models just don't exist.
Gotcha. Real quick question about, I either dreamed this or read this somewhere or you tweet or whatever, that you're going to be doing a presentation with your husband. First of all, is that true?
We did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
tell us a little bit about that.
So my husband, Peter Lamont, is the Senior Vice President of Digital Strategy for a PR consultancy in Washington, D.C. called Levick. And they focus a lot on, you know, issues on the Hill and on crisis communications and digital communications. But before he worked at Levick, he ran a startup called Genius Rocket, a video crowdsourcing firm. So this is a new job for him. And he and I have always had really great conversations around entrepreneurship. And so we co-keynoted a startup conference in Indiana. Indianapolis has a burgeoning startup scene, and Wabash College held the startup fair, and that's where we co-presented. I think we've tossed around in the past the opportunity to work together, to start a business together. We've got lots of overlapping interests. We actually met in business school. But I think for the sake of our relationship, we are best served working individually and not together.
That's kind of wonderful. Well, we have about 2 minutes left to the show. And so, Susan, where can people find and connect with you? What are your travel plans for this year? Can you please share that?
Sure. So you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Susan Lamont. Again, taking out this prayer. You can also certainly find me at Exaquio. It's spelled E-X-A-Q-U-E-O, exaquio.com. We have a blog there that we update regularly. We just launched a really interesting white paper on the state of the workforce and whether the economy has any impact on that. And then we've got a fair amount of speaking engagements and travel coming up later this week. I'll be at HRMAC in Chicago with a great panel of folks talking about Talent Act and digital. And then in April, I'll be doing a webinar for Brazen Careerists on talent communities. And then in May, I've got a fair amount of travel. I'll be at Influence HR, which if you're listening today and you're a vendor, please Google Influence HR. I think it's going to be a fantastic conference for people that are selling into the HR space. And then I'll be hitting the Recruiting Innovation Summit in San Francisco. And then for any of you that are recruiting in the MBA space, let me know. I've got an invitation-only conference that I'm managing called Human Capital Connection at Vanderbilt at the end of May as well. So lots of travel coming up, more than I did last year, but you know, I love doing it and I love getting out there and seeing many folks that I don't get a chance to connect with when I'm head down doing client work.
Well, awesome. Awesome opportunity to connect with Susan, and I can't wait to meet you at Chicago Shrimp Conference.
Well, excellent. Looking forward to it.
Well, Susan, thank you for being here. It's been such a great conversation. So, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening to Drive to HR, and we are out of here.